Whether you're just looking to stay warm during a hunt or need maximum concealment, the clothing you wear can make or break a hunt. At MidwayUSA.com, we understand hunting clothing has come a long way with more meticulously crafted camo patterns, advanced scent control technologies, and weatherproof options to withstand the elements. Hunters have to wait until their favorite season, but shouldn't wait on gear, which is why MidwayUSA offers super fast shipping. When you're ready for your next system, log on to MidwayUSA.com.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Well, this sucks. So how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you holding up?
Good. Getting excited for April 1st.
You and me both. I am itching to get out of the house and get in the bush. So I'm really excited about getting out, even just doing some scouting. I mean, I think this spring for me is going to be helping a lot more friends get out there. I've got a few friends that want to get out for their first time. So I'm going to be doing some of that, get the wife out.
Yeah, that's always fun. I try to get out with the kids and the wife and do some shed hunting every spring. So get out and nice. Do some of that. Helps me for the whitetails too. Keeps me up to date on what's going on with those buggers.
Seems to be
a year-long thing where you got to chase whitetails.
Oh, man. It's a lifelong thing if you're chasing whitetails, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But no, whitetails are tough, man. It's like chasing ghosts. It's, well, not that blacktail hunting isn't, but whitetail, I think, is more to do with, scouting it out and find where those big dogs are at. Blacktail is just, you got to be crazy to hunt blacktail. Yeah. But I still do it.
You're on the coast, aren't you? Are you in Squamish?
Yeah, I'm out here in Squamish. So mostly blacktail in the immediate area, or we do some muley hunting. I normally do my whitetail hunting early season while I'm out for my elk hunt in the Kootenays.
I was out in the Kootenays last year, got two goats on our way back out. I was able to snag a nice 6x6. So yeah.
That's a rodeo.
Yeah, it was a gnarly trip. Joe, thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So Joe, I'm super stoked to get you on the show here today. And, I know you're a big bear hunter and, I want to get into talk bears, but, maybe before we get into that discussion, maybe you can give a bit about your backstory, tell the folks who are listening a bit of who you are and that sort of thing.
An elevator pitch.
Let's go with your elevator pitch.
Small town BC kid. I grew up in, Bracondale, BC, or Squamish, BC. I grew up in the outdoors, hunting, fishing, mushrooming, all of the above, but my real, kick in the can, or probably what you're interested in speaking about, is the fact that, I had a career in professional sports that kicked off through, football. I went down to Washington State University. I was on a full ride scholarship down there for football. From there, I was drafted second overall in the 2010 CFL draft by the Toronto Argonauts. With them, I had an absolute blast, a great career, and was fortunate enough to win the 100th Grey Cup with them in 2012, which was an absolutely amazing career for me. Unfortunately, following that, a lot of my injuries started catching up to me. So I decided to make a career transition, got out of football, went back to school, got my MBA, and took on a career in marketing and sales. And that career took a lot of different turns. I worked for an athletic supplement company for quite a while. And then slowly over time, it transitioned into the current role I have now, which is with Wild TV Network and our three sister networks, which is Cowboy Channel, RFD TV, and Water Network. And I'm also a host on The Edge, which is one of our top programs on Wild TV. So it's been quite a wild journey, and I've been fortunate enough to chase a lot of, you know, my life's dreams. And yeah, it seems to be this constant winding path, and who knows where I'll end up next.
I found out a cool fact about the Edge, that it's, I think it's one of the only Canadian hunting shows that is available to our folks down south.
Yes. We actually are available in over 55 million households in the US through our various network partnerships. And we're also available on Amazon Prime. And some of our network deals actually have provided us with quite a bit of exposure in Europe as well. So it's pretty cool to be able to be on a platform where we reach that many individuals.
Yeah, 55 million. I mean, that's pretty cool. You got more people down there than you do up here watching your show. That's cool.
Yeah, and we pull in some pretty good analytics. And, you know, it's kind of funny. After I retired from pro football, I never thought I'd be on a platform where I reached that many audience members again. And, you know, being able to be in this position and share, you know, my true passion, which is my passion for the outdoors, has always far surpassed my passion for football or any of my other athletic endeavors. So, you know, being able to be in a role like this, it's still kind of surreal, and I got to pinch myself from time to time.
Yeah, I bet. So how did that all come to play? You getting on with those boys over at the Edge?
It was a bit of an interesting journey. I think it probably all started a few years back when Steve Eklund, my now co-host, got in some hot water, and there was a bunch of controversy around his cougar kill, if you remember that.
Yeah, I do. And Steve, I've spoke to Steve. Steve was, he was going to come on the show a while ago, and then he had to bail last minute, and then we just haven't been able to reconnect. But Steve's a beauty, and I remember that. He kind of got held to the coals on that one.
Yeah, it was crazy. For some reason, he just ended up with a target on his back. You know, obviously, a lot of individuals go out and hunt cougars, and he even did a post about, you know, preparing it. I think it was a stir fry dish after the hunt. And for some reason, everybody just went after him. So fortunately enough, I was in Toronto at the time, and through my athletic career, I had a strong relationship with the news outlets. So I got a call one morning from CBC, and they said, "Hey Joe, you know, the hunters as a whole are just being drugged through the coals right now because of this, you know, cougar kill. Would you be willing to come on live news and defend hunters?"
Dude, I was, it's funny you brought that up. I was going to ask you about that, because that's not an easy conversation to have. I think a lot of it had to do with what Harper's wife said, but man, you handled that like a pro on there.
It was a strange conversation for me, I guess is the best way to put it. But, you know, when I woke up, they reached out and they said, "You know what? We know you hunt," and they knew me well enough as an individual. They were like, "You could probably do a good job justifying that side of the story. If you don't come on, there's a good chance this side of the story won't be told. You know, like, I want to pitch to the network. You can come on and provide your side of the story." So I was like, "Well, yes, absolutely. I'll jump at that opportunity and I'll speak up for hunters." But I had never been on a hound hunt. I had never been on a cougar hunt. I had grown up hunting in BC and seen cougars in the wild, but I'd never actually actively hunted one. But at the same time, I didn't want to pass this opportunity to have our side of the story be told. So I accepted the opportunity, and I had a few hours before I actually had to be in studio recording live news. And I just got on the phone and I started calling everybody in my network. And I got as much information on the subject as I possibly could. And fortunately for me, I had a lot of great people that were willing to have long conversations and you know, help me out. I mean, obviously I knew the general information about conservation, the general information about hunting, but the specific nuances to hound hunting and cougar hunting were completely foreign to me. So spent the whole morning doing research, ended up on live news. I would like to think I did a relatively decent job defending Steve and defending hunters as a whole.
Dude, and you killed it. You killed it. That's not easy. Looking at that, like, man, and it's like being a hunter, like just being a hunter in, like, you're a target. Like these days you're a target. Nowadays, you know, back in the day, it used to be whatever, right? People just shrug it off. Like, oh, whatever, he hunts, puts food on the table. Now it's like, you know, they just look at you like they just ostracize you. I don't know why, but it's unfortunate.
It was interesting though, because after that interview, I actually stepped off and there was a group of individuals from CBC head office, people that work behind the scenes, that actually came up to me and said, "Wow, Joe, like, we had no idea about all that information you just shared. Will you come over and have like kind of a round table with us?" And I spoke with a large group of individuals who were like a mixed bag of vegans, vegetarians, like just people that never really left downtown Toronto. So it was completely foreign to them. And after that conversation, a bunch of them were like, "You know what? I may never hunt myself, but I have a full new respect for, you know, hunters and what they do. And it actually makes more sense." So like, that was my first like real light bulb moment where I realized there's not enough conversation around what we do. We just say we're conservationists, but we don't necessarily pursue it or go in depth enough at times to share the message. But before I go down that tangent, the question was about how I ended up with The Edge and Wild TV. So this interview happened, and then my life kind of just kept progressing through sales and marketing and whatnot. But then years later, I realized that I really had a strong passion to, I needed to get back to BC. I wanted to get back to the outdoors. And eventually I moved back to British Columbia and I saw a position right through the grapevine. I heard about an opening as a host with Wild TV. So I reached out to them and I was like, there's no way that I'll be lucky enough to be selected for this. And I, just through a few different calls with some of the individuals at Wild TV head office, they got back to me and they're like, "Yeah, we want you to come on and be a part of Wild TV family, but we want you to be a co-host of our show, The Edge." And I mean, that's like, for me at the time, I'm like, that's in the football career, that's like playing community league football and then being drafted to the NFL. It was such a big jump and a big leap. And it was just one of those opportunities that was too good for me to pass up. So fortunately enough, I kind of just dove in blindly and I said, absolutely, I would be extremely honored to take that opportunity. And here I am now. I'm filming my third season with The Edge. And it has been an absolute blast. It's been a bit of a whirlwind, but it's been a crazy ride so far. And I hope that this third season is just still the one of many, many to come.
No, it's that's quite the story. And yeah, working with Steve, and I don't know if Steve gets enough credit. That guy's a killer. Anybody who follows Steve Eklund knows that he harvests so many great, like, and not only, he's just built for TV. It seems like, that guy, you know what I mean? Like, he makes it exciting. And I don't know if he does it deliberately, but he'll be like, "Oh, I'm on a 7-day hunt here, or I'm on a 5-day hunt." And he always seems to get the animal on the last day or right close to the end of the hunt.
Yeah. When you mentioned that, I was going to say, not only is he an amazing hunter and he's extremely successful, but it always seems to be that he gets himself into these cliffhanger situations and he'll pass up on animals that most individuals would be over the moon to take. And I don't know how he does it. I mean, granted, sometimes his success comes on day 17 of a 10-day hunt. I think he uses up a few sick days. But I've spoke with our cameraman a few times and they always say it. They're like, "You know what? I don't know how Steve does it." And every time Steve's going on some of these longer trips, he'll speak to the camera guy and say, "You know what? Like, we're going to go for a max of X number of days, but if we're successful, we'll obviously come back early." And some of these camera guys, like, they're big trips, so they'll commit to it based on that. And say, "Okay, you know what, it'd be great to get back early." But they were laughing because they said, "You know what, it's never early and it's almost always a few days late because Steve holds off to the last moment." But it's like he knows in the back of his mind, if he holds out one extra day, it's like a guarantee that this magnificent animal will come across. He's got a horseshoe hidden somewhere, that's for sure.
Somebody told me once, and everybody's heard the saying, never pass on something you'd shoot on the last day. And still to this day, I follow by that motto. I don't know. I mean, I've passed up on some animals, but man, I don't have the confidence that something else is going to walk out and he's going to be a Boone and Crockett.
Yeah, no, it's tough. And I mean, even for myself, it's a challenge. I grew up, we were sustenance hunters. Like, we literally hunted to continue to put food on our table. That's what we did. Wild game was a huge, huge part of our diet. We picked wild mushrooms, we fished, we gardened, like that's where our food came from. So there was a lot of times where, like, if we went out, like, we shot spikes, we shot all of the above. And the idea of, you know, let them grow, wait for the big guys was never something. Like, I looked and I'm like, I see a steak with horns right now. So I'm pulling the trigger. And then since then, I've obviously learned more, and I'm much more selective. And I'm also fortunate enough that I get to spend a lot more time outdoors, which gives me the opportunities to be a little more selective at times. But this man has an ability that most people would not. Like, he passes up on animals and he'll just look and say, nope. Like, that's an absolute, he sends me pictures when he's on his trips, and he sends me like pictures of animals that he lets walk. And in my mind, I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, dude, that's like not just any hunter, but like a very, very, very
ballsy man. It's just so
a very selective hunter would take that and still be proud. And he's just like, nah, it's not one for me today.
No, it's coming. Just wait. Wait, wait. I told you. I told you it was coming. Yeah. No. Mm-hmm. Pretty sick. That's for sure. Yeah. I was gonna say too, that's one thing. Having time, finding the time to do it it's tough. And I know Steve, he's busy. I know for myself, I found a lot more time just with my business. It's allowed me to have a lot more time to spend on the backcountry. And, you know, I think last year I must have spent close to 100 days. You know, that includes scouting, checking trail cameras and all that. And
wow.
Yeah. I still, like I said, though, I still don't have that confidence. I don't know if you gain it or you just have it, but no, it's something special for sure.
Well, you know, even spending 100 days in the backcountry, you still have to be incredibly fortunate to come across, in some of the areas, just to come across a legal animal, let alone like a respectable legal animal. And then to be able to go into some of these areas and not only come out with a respectable legal animal, but like an absolute, like, it's like fishing in a mud puddle and you pull out like this giant whale. It just, sometimes it doesn't even make sense, the animals he pulls out of areas.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like with cougars, we spent a fair bit of time cougar hunting this fall. And back to that conversation about hunting with dogs. And, you know, I was going to say earlier, I think that's one of the misconceptions that a lot of people have, that is when you're hunting with dogs, that it's easy. And it's not. I mean, this year I spent close to 30 days chasing a cat. And, you know, a lot of those days, over half of those days, we spent with dogs. You know, I have a friend who trains dogs and thinks that you just let these dogs go and all of a sudden it trees the cat. But no, it doesn't work like that. It's, you know, it's funny how people have that conception of hunting with dogs. I mean, when you hunt with dogs, there's a lot that goes into it. These guys, they're dedicated to these dogs. And yeah, it's there's nothing easy about it, for sure.
Nope, undoubtedly. And I think actually way back in the day, that was my first kind of real time I looked into hound hunting and the whole process. And from that day, I gained this huge desire to go out and be a part of a hound hunt. And I've been on multiple hound hunts since then. And that was the biggest surprise. I actually, even despite, you know, the fact that I had interviewed so many people, like, or not interviewed, but spoken to so many people about hound hunting and sought out so much information about it. I still, in the back of my mind, just imagined you're driving along the road, you see a track, dump the dogs, 15 minutes later, you got a cat in a tree. That's what I envisioned. And I went on a lot of hunts where we weren't even successful putting a cat up a tree. The snow conditions weren't right. The cat managed to double back over its tracks and confuse the dogs, or it went through a swamp or swam a river, whatever it may be. There is so much more to that process than just finding a track, dumping the dogs, guaranteed tree. Like, that's not how it works out. And I mean, I went on a lot of cat hunts. I was able to harvest my first cougar this year. And I'm kind of glad that it was that much of a challenge to get to the point where I took my first cougar, because I had so much more appreciation for the whole process by the time I was successful.
Yeah.
I really understood that. And I had so much more appreciation for how much work these houndsmen have to put in to keep their dogs prepared and keep them ready for it.
Yeah. There's so many variables that go into that. I couldn't believe it. I think it's tough, and it's tough to get that education out there of, and the thing is, I don't think unless you actually do it, I don't think you can appreciate it. Like you said,
no.
Until you actually do it, like even being a hunter and growing up in a hunter, you still don't understand it until you actually go do it. And it is hard. There's nothing easy about it. Like you said, a lot of people just think, and even people I talk to today that are friends I hunt with, they're like, oh, how was that? You just let the dogs go and then you go shoot the cat? No, man. It's like, you need to go try it. Like, come out for a day and like, just, yeah, you'd be surprised how tough it is.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. And like you said, I mean, it's difficult to understand and to explain to somebody who hasn't been a part of it. I went out of my way and sought out conversations with so many people who had done it. And I thought I understood it. And then still going out and doing it myself, my understanding was nowhere near what the actual process is like and the amount of work that goes into it. And the number of, another thing I really appreciate is the number of kills, the number of animal kills we came across through the process.
Yes.
During those unsuccessful hunts. Mm-hmm. I also realized, you know, as a hunter, we understand the importance of predator control, but I realized in some of those moments how much of a positive impact we could have for some of these ungulates in pulling a cougar out of those areas.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that it blows your mind when you realize how destructive those cats are. And it's going to be a real shame if things turn out the way that certain groups are pushing right now, I'll tell you that much.
That's another big conversation. Yeah, we really have to, as hunters, as not even just as hunters, but as anybody who appreciates the outdoors, we really, right now is a very important time for us to stand up and back science-based and evidence-based wildlife management. It's not even just about protecting our right as hunters or anything. It's about science and evidence-based wildlife management. That's the fight that we're in right now. So it's hunters, it's backpackers, it's fishermen, it's anyone who loves the outdoors should be concerned about what we're up against.
And you know, there's evidence of it right now. I mean, it's funny when you watch BC news and people are complaining about how many cougar sightings there are all of a sudden and how many coyotes attacks there are and wolf sightings and, you know, confrontations with bears. And it blows my mind that people can even question for not educating yourself to understanding what's really going on. And then all of a sudden wonder why. Yeah. It just blows my mind. I don't know. I would myself, I would never question anything I didn't understand.
No, but
like you said, we can get going down this road. And yeah. I'm far too emotional of a person to get going on it. Cause I get kind of frustrated and aggravated.
Yeah. That'll get me fired up and we'll be here for 3 hours talking. But I mean, I see firsthand frustrating things that I see is, for example, I live here in Squamish, BC, and you know, it's an area where we never saw grizzly bears when I was growing up, but this year we had to relocate two grizzly bears that came into town. So it's because they're coming into town for whatever reason they're coming into town. But rather than have what was in place before where there was, you know, a select number of grizzly bears were harvested to prevent overpopulation or whatever, provide them enough space because grizzly bears are extremely territorial, and creating revenue that gave back to wildlife management, that gave back to, you know, research on these animals and everything, rather than having that and having everything properly managed. Now, all of a sudden we're at the time where we're having issues where problem bears are coming into town, they're having to be relocated. And now rather than generating revenue and generating money to keep, you know, these populations in check and healthy, we're spending tax dollars to relocate these animals. And guess what's going to happen? Those animals are going to go in the bush and they're either going to get dropped into the territory of another younger dominant bear and they're either going to die in battle or they're going to get pushed right back into town. Like that's just what happens. So
exactly.
We don't need to go into that because I'll go nuts, but huge conversation to have there.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't I can't even. So we'll back up a little bit here then. Now hunting and pro sports, I guess, well, you know, pro winter or pro fall sports, I guess, you know, those two don't really jive. And I was talking to Shea Weber the end of this summer, and you know, he plays for the Montreal Canadiens, and him and I were talking, and he was interested in getting hunting, and he wanted to know the processes of getting into hunting and what he needed to do to make that happen. And he found himself with COVID, he was able to you know, actually get out this year and do a bit of hunting. And, you know, that my question for you is, when you're playing pro sports, how did hunting fit into that, to your schedule?
To be perfectly honest, hunting took a backseat. I was at a time in my life where I had complete tunnel vision on my athletic career. I saw an opportunity to improve my life. So I kind of, when I see things, I can be pretty focused, and I went full bore towards my athletic career. And there's some stuff where I definitely regret. I missed out on a lot of great opportunities for hunting, but I mean, my sport kept me busy throughout the peak hunting season, which was the fall. In my career then, I had never really grown up doing much predator hunting or spring hunts. So my focus was purely in the fall. I did get out when I did have opportunities, I'd try and get out as much as possible, but it certainly took a back seat. And then it wasn't till I kept telling myself, you know, I always have this time, I can make up for it. I'll get out on these big hunts. And my dad and I used to talk a lot about, you know, doing some big backcountry hunts or these big fly-in destinations. And then actually towards the end of my athletic career, my father was diagnosed with brain cancer and very quickly lost that battle. So I was by his side. We talked a lot about it and reflected on a lot of things. And at that time, I kind of had this mental shift where I realized I wanted to be living a life that I wasn't putting off what I wanted to be doing. And that was a big part of my, I mentioned earlier that my injuries caught up to me, but I could have continued to play for quite a while despite my injuries. But I think there was the injuries paired with this mental shift of getting back to what was really important to me in life. And that's ultimately why I retired and eventually made my move back to BC and start chasing what was important. And unfortunately, that transition happened too late for my father and I to make up on some of those trips we always dreamed about. But, I like to think that he's still with me and he still appreciates what we're up to.
He'd be proud of what you're doing. And, you know, I can kind of relate to that. My wife's dad, him and I were really, really close. And, he died early. He had cancer as well, and he died early. But it was one of those things where we always talked about getting out into doing a big hunt. And, I had a business, so I always put it off. And I said, well, I can't go this year, next year. And then, he ended up getting sick and we never got a chance to take that trip. And, I definitely regret not doing it now when I could have had the opportunity, but,
it's one of those things that I think everybody goes, even if you're raised hunting, I think everybody goes through a bit of a phase where, your priorities kind of shift and change. And I mean, eventually we typically kind of complete the circle and come back to a place. And I think obviously I have regrets because of the opportunities I missed with my father, but at the same time, my time away from hunting, helped me appreciate it that much more, because growing up hunting in coastal BC, I was extremely, extremely fortunate. And I had a lot of people that always used to tell me, don't take it for granted. But at the same time, when that's all, you can't help but take it for granted on some levels. So the fact that I spent so much of my career being pulled away from it and not having those opportunities, now that I'm back here and I'm able to, get back to what's important to myself, I'm able to share it with a lot of people and I have this whole new appreciation for it. And I see why it's so important for me just getting outdoors, whether it's hunting or not. I see that I struggle as a person if I'm not able to get outdoors on a regular basis. I'll go into a bit of a rut, So, yeah. I think that's elevated my appreciation for it to a whole new level.
Yeah, no, I get it 100%. That's one thing about being a BC boy, and I grew up on the coast as well. And, just fishing and hunting and getting outside was just something you took for granted. I mean, here in BC, we're pretty damn spoiled with what we got. And, I'm in the same way. If I don't get out, I get pretty damn cranky. That's for sure. Mm-hmm.
But it's probably also one of those things where, you've realized over time that, the more time you spend away from it, the more time you realize what you've been missing out on.
Yeah, exactly. And you also appreciate what we have and what you got and just to make the time of it when you have it. When I had my kids, I think that's when the switch really flipped for me was, because I remembered, same thing, getting out hunting with my father. And that's definitely something you want to continue on. But
absolutely. And you're creating memories. I mean, not only for yourself as an individual, like for you selfishly, but you're creating memories that will last forever for your children. And you're also instilling values that will mold who they become, right? Like you, hunting teaches you so much about life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's yourself. not just the basic life and death and that concept, but challenging yourself, pushing past what you think your limits are, mm-hmm. You know, perseverance, Steve's patience, the ability to hold out and wait for what's really, you know, what you really want to get after, different things like that. I think it's amazing. And it teaches you, it also teaches you a huge part about the fact that every action has a consequence.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is a big one. And I think a lot of people are able to separate themselves from the consequences of their actions nowadays. And hunting is one of those ones where it's very real, very in your face. And, you know, if you make a mistake when you're in the mountain, you bring the wrong gear, you're the one paying for it. If you take an animal's life in the backcountry, you got to get it back to your truck. You have to deal with the emotional burden of having killed an animal, but you have to, you know, make sure that you use the animal to its fullest. Like I know for me as a hunter, when I bring meat home, if I'm eating dinner and, you know, I cook someone a steak and they don't finish it, like, and they're like, oh, I'll just throw this in the garbage. I'm like, there is no chance in hell you're throwing that steak in the garbage. Like, but my perception of what goes into that meat and where it came from is so much different than somebody who could just go to the store, buy it, never see the animal they had to kill, never have to pack that food out of the bush, never be associated with that connection at all.
Yeah, they don't appreciate it at all. It's not even close. When you go to the store and you buy a steak, it's not even close to what you feel when you're barbecuing something that, you know, it took you, you sweated for that thing, you know, you sacrificed time away. And yeah, there's
you pull the trigger on that animal. And when I do that, I have a commitment, like a social commitment to that animal that, you know, I took your life, but I'm going to make sure that that was not in vain, that that wasn't a waste for you. I mean, I'm sure the animal may or may not care because it's already deceased, but I'm not going to let that go to waste when I already know, like, I literally had to kill an animal to put that food on your plate. Like, so that steak is not going to waste. I don't care what happens. It's not going in the trash.
Yep. That's a big part of it too. And that's something, yeah, you see so much of it. I mean, not with game meat, but just with food in general. And you're not letting an elk steak get thrown in the trash. There's no way.
No, that's gold. An elk steak. That's gold. That's top dollar right there.
Absolutely. I think my uncle was telling me about how much elk goes for. More expensive than halibut.
I would believe it, because if I did a cost breakdown on what I spend on my hunting gear and my
even want to know. I can't do that math. I can't do that math. It's just
I mean, I could get caviar cheaper.
I definitely do not count receipts, that's for sure.
Oh, those go in the campfire.
Yeah, and I definitely do not let my wife see them either.
Smart man, very smart man.
Transitioning from football to hunting, you know, they're both physically and mentally demanding. I imagine, you know, the mental toughness is that you had playing football, you know, that competitiveness you need for pro ball is pretty similar in, you know, with backcountry hunting. But, you know, the physical aspect, I guess, is the two are probably a lot different. You know, with football, depending on your position, you need to be, you know, big and solid, whereas, you know, in the backcountry, light and flexible are gonna benefit you more. How was that? You know, what were some of the biggest adjustments going from playing pro football to be now a, you know, a pro backcountry hunter in terms of, you know, the physical nuances?
The physical nuances was definitely a shift. I mean, during my professional career as a football player, like I literally threw around 300 pound men for a living. And we were just clashing in the trenches on every play. So I was on average 300 plus and lifting extreme amounts of weight, putting my body through this ultimate stress. But, it was bursts. It was energy. I had to prepare for a few hours of competition and then I had all of this time to recover. Well, a physique like that is great if you want to hunt from a truck, if you want to hunt flatlands. But if your passion is backcountry hunting, everything about my previous build worked against me as a hunter, because 300 pounds, especially the way I was built, I was, without being, you know, too self-promoting or whatever, like I was relatively well built as a football player. I didn't let myself be a fatty. I was fat enough when I was a kid, and you know, I made sure I was well built for my 300 plus pounds during my football career. But
yeah, well, you know, you're 300, but you're talking on a 6'8" frame. So
yes.
Now a 6'8" man in the backcountry, to me, you must burn through trekking poles. Unless you must, or either that, or just carry like 20 mil rebar for trekking.
I burned through a lot in the backcountry. I bet. Kind of the direction I was going. But yeah, I mean, trekking poles, you name it, gear is extremely difficult to find for big guys. Because yeah, I mean, even my boots, the average person wears through their boots at one rate. But for me, I've got that much more torque. I'm heavier going in on my hunts than most people are coming out fully loaded if they've had a successful hunt. And that's without, I mean, heck, I'm heavier than most people before I even put my backpack on. But the other crazy thing that I was getting to as well is, for my body type, when you have that much muscle on your frame, you burn an insane amount of calories and you fatigue so quickly. So your endurance is relatively low and your requirement for food is so high. So when I started getting into backcountry hunting, I was like, oh, this is great. I'm huge. I'm stubborn as a mule. I can push through anything. Well, I was burning out so quickly. I mean, yes, my knees, my ankles were fatiguing. My legs were like, okay, I can squat whatever 600 plus pounds, but that's only for a short burst of time. Then all of a sudden it's like, no, I got to climb this mountain. And it was this whole new learning curve. I had to relearn my body. And the more weight, the more muscle you have on the frame, which is a bigger engine, means the more fuel you need. So it was like this, it was this compounding issue, because the bigger you are, the more fuel you need, which means the more food you have, which ultimately means the more weight you have. And it's a vicious cycle, because then you're burning more calories.
Yeah, well, I mean,
extra weight.
It's just compounding, right? I mean, you're big to begin with, but big means everything has to be big, right? Big, you know, lots more food. Like you said, a bigger engine needs a lot more fuel. That's for sure.
Yeah. So it's a constant challenge. And for myself, it's funny, my entire career, I mentioned I was fat when I was a kid. Then I got involved in like a higher level of athletics and I dropped a bunch of weight, and I spent my entire professional career struggling to keep my weight up there because my body wanted to drop weight. Well, now that I've retired, my body's really happy at around 280, which is not convenient in the backcountry. So now I'm back to this constant battle of trying to reduce my weight so I can be a more optimal physique in the backcountry, because I want to be lighter. The lighter I am, the easier I'll go up the mountains.
Training, that's got to be a challenge, training, because, you know, one thing about when you build muscle is you know, it's muscle memory. You always have that. So being a big guy and a pro athlete, I imagine, you know, 300 plus pounds, you had a lot of muscle on you. Now, when you're training, your legs, I imagine you probably go work your legs one day and then all of a sudden they probably look like water balloons, right? Like they're just like, everything must just go back to where it wants to be, because you did it for so long that its natural instinct is to just gain mass again. Like, so training must be tough for you as well.
You hit the nail on the head there. It's been a challenge, and it's a science I'm still trying to figure out on my own, actually, because that's my problem. I like to do some of these lifts, and obviously leg strength is important in the backcountry, and I do have strong legs, so I don't worry about it too much. But as soon as I can walk past a deadlift platform and my legs grow 2 inches. And I don't even have to look at the weight. It just happens, because my body is like, oh, Joe needs to get huge. He spent 15, 20 years of his life trying to get huge. This is what needs to happen. So I'm changing my training style. I do a lot more hiking, jogging, weighted pack work, body weight movements. I do a lot more of that now. But it's a constant challenge, because I notice no matter what style of training I'm doing, my legs want to grow. And I see some of these other backpack hunters, and they have these strong but slender legs for hiking. And I look at them and I'm so envious, because I want that so bad. And I see them, they get to back squat, they get to deadlift, and they're like, yeah, this is great. And I know for a fact, if I do that, I will split the seams in my pants on my next hike. Like it's just a fact for me.
It's got to be tricky, man, because muscle memory is a funny thing. And not only that, just the mental the mental part of training, where, you know what I mean? Like, I imagine you're a really competitive guy, so you can't just grab a dumbbell and be like, oh yeah, yeah, okay, well, that's good. That's good. It's got to be all or nothing, right? Like, just crank it out. Yeah. Yeah. So like, just that whole adjustment must just be something else.
My wife laughs at me a lot because of that. I mean, I still listen to like the locker room speeches on my phone when I'm working out, and I mentally get my head and push myself harder. And I'm not really good at going to the gym and not just going all out. And I will admit there's a certain level of ego in it. So I'll go to the gym now, and I'm not willing to accept the fact that I'm getting older and I have retired from my professional career as an athlete. And even in those times where I am successful in cutting my weight down, and I'm getting closer to my ultimate goal of being, you know, a lighter backcountry hunter in that style, I'll be at the gym and some young kid will come in and start throwing a bunch of weight on the bar. And I look over and it's extremely difficult to push back the urge to go start packing weight on again and try and get back to where I used to be. So it's this constant battle.
I get it. I'm 42 years old and I played sports my whole life. I am an extremely competitive person. And if I see anybody doing one thing, I'm like, nope, I'll see if I can do more. I know it's going to hurt later, but you know, I totally get where you're coming from. It's tough too. And you're a big guy too. So, I mean, you know, people look at you and say, okay, well, this guy's going to go, you know, he's going to put 3 plates on each side and he's going to bang out 12, you know, 12 reps on the bench press. And yeah, I get it. It's not easy.
Yeah, no, those days are behind me, but there's certainly moments where I struggle with it. So, but that's the thing. You just have to kind of shift your focus, and I find new ways to challenge myself, right? And I have to continually remind myself that that's probably the best thing that I don't want to say the best thing, but one of the best things for me in my retirement from professional sports. And it made it less of a, I guess, mental and emotional impact. Because I know a lot of guys that struggle quite heavily when they retire from professional sports, you know, with their identity or with finding a replacement, because that is such a direct, immediate, like, you have goals that are right in front of you. You have challenges, and it's just this battle component that like kind of feeds something on a different level for us. And
it's that warrior's retiring edge that you just, yes, you need it. You need that when you're playing sports. Like, you need it. You have to have it. If you don't have it, you're not going to survive. And then, you know, it's like these guys, they went to war and they have that to get it taken away. You need something to fill that hole and fill that gap. And, you know, that's, you know, talking to guys who are in that situation and they turn to hunting and they find nuances, you know, something to fill that void, you know, with hunting.
Right. And that's actually a really good way of putting it. And I agree. Like, it's a difficult transition. I would never compare what we did in sports to, you know, going to war or going to battle or anything like that. But I mean, I literally, during our Grey Cup campaign in 2012, like, there's drives where, like, you're fighting, you're in there, it's very brutal. Like, I had a dislocated finger, and for one drive, it was 16 plays in one drive. And every single play I had to put my finger back in, it was dislocated. The one finger kept going sideways. And like, you're doing things like this and you get to see individuals around you tested and pushed to their limits, and guys, you know, they're literally out there playing with broken bones. You're battling. You get to see people in their core element. Like, you get to see what people are really made of. And I could never imagine just transitioning straight from that into a desk job, a 9-to-5. I think that would have killed me inside. And I think a lot of people struggle because of that when they do retire. So having something that's such a healthy outlet, such as, you know, backcountry hunting or getting outdoors, like you said, you can literally choose to push yourself, whether it be purely mentally, purely emotionally, purely physically. Like, you can, at whatever level, you can push yourself as hard as you possibly want. I mean, there's a lot of individuals that go on hunts that I don't think I would ever be able to push myself to go on. But at the same time, I know that every year I try and set my goals, and I look at hunts and I go, geez, like, I like to go on a lot that I'm like, I'm not 100% confident that I'll be able to pull it off. And I go in with the mindset that I don't care what it takes, I'm going to do it, but I want to find my new limits or push past my old perceived limits.
That's what I love about hunting. It's that, you know, it's that unknown, that challenge that you can always choose to challenge yourself. And you know, the thing is, you don't have to choose to do that. Do you know what I mean? There's so many different aspects and there's so many different things about hunting that you can just choose to, and you're never too old to get into it. You're never too old to love this way of life. I mean, you know what I mean? You can be 40 years old, you can be 50 years old, and you can still get into hunting. You can still enjoy it and have a great time.
Absolutely. And I mean, you're never too old or too young to get involved in the outdoors. And the worst day in the bush, the least successful hunt, will still teach you so much about yourself as an individual. And in my opinion, the worst day in the bush is still better than any day sitting in an office. And I know that most people agree with me there. So, the worst hunt is the best hike.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Spring bear is approaching. You're in April 1st. I already have both my bear tags. Nice. What do you got planned for spring bear?
I'm hoping to get out a lot. I think my initial focus, I have some friends here in town that have always been very interested in bear hunting. I have one friend that I actually got out on one trip with him last year. We passed on a few smaller bears. So I really want to help him get one spot in stock. My wife, I always try and make sure that she gets a bear in the spring as well. So that's a great one for her and I to get out on. And to be honest, I think with what's been going on this past year with, you know, the quarantines and whatnot, I really want to do a few days backcountry and go for alpine bear. I mean, alpine bears are my favorite, the berry bears up, you know, high country. So that's kind of my general goals for springtime. Whether, you know, that'll all come together or not is yet to be seen, but first and foremost, I'm just looking forward to having a really good excuse to get out of the house and get in the backcountry.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Your wife's into it. I can get my wife into coming deer hunting, but there's just no way I can talk her into coming out bear hunting. But
it's not for everybody. And I mean, most hunters don't, and that's everybody's choice. But I grew up, I didn't hunt bear. My family didn't hunt bear. And then I started, you know, and I heard a lot of people talk about how bad the meat was and they didn't like bear meat. So that's why they never hunted bear. And then I heard from a few friends that had been to these wild game dinners and said, you know what, the best meat they had there was a berry bear, an alpine berry bear. And it was so delicious. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, maybe I should try things for myself. Cause I've had bad deer. Like I've had bad venison in the past. And normally it's because the person that shot the deer and took care of the deer and butchered it didn't necessarily do the best job. So it wasn't great meat care. So then I was like, okay, well, maybe I shouldn't just take everybody else's word for it. I want to go out and get myself a bear and see what I think of the meat for myself. And I mean, my first bear wasn't even a berry bear and the meat was delicious, but it was extremely important. I mean, bear meat can spoil really quickly. So you want to get it processed and dealt with really quick. And then in my mind, I'm like, okay, well, maybe I'm just convincing myself that it's delicious. So I started cooking it for friends and family and other people. And everybody was like, wow, this is amazing. And nobody would believe me when I told them it was bear meat.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the bigger ones is that bear meat's bad. I think, well, the funny thing is too, is people say, oh, bear meat's gross. Well, have you ever had it? No. Well, what the fuck are you talking about then?
Yeah, how do you know it's bad unless you've done it? And that's the other thing is like I said, I've been exposed to other meat from like elk or moose or deer that doesn't taste good. And I'm like, there's no way that anybody could mess up those animals, but it comes down to care after you kill the animal. Like, how do you process it and do all of that? So through that, I kind of realized, holy cow, bear meat is delicious. And it's actually like one that we look forward to. When I pull bear out of the freezer, like it's an exciting thing. Awesome. We're going to have bear meat. And I have friends that, you know, if they're coming over for dinner, and I absolutely love sharing wild game with friends and family, and, you know, getting to sit down and share stories and share the product of those hunts with them. And I always ask friends before they come over, like, what do you want? Do we want to go out and pull some crab traps, or do we want to have some venison, elk? What is it? And I have quite a few friends that if they're coming over for dinner, they request bear meat.
Yeah, no, I love sharing meat too. And I love sharing it a little too much, but I just can't help myself. I looked at my freezer the other day when my dad was over. I pulled out a couple elk steaks for him and I, and I can see the bottom of the freezer. And I mean, last year I shot two bear, mountain goat, elk, two deer, and an antelope, and I could still, and a cougar this winter, and I can still see the bottom of my freezer. So
it's time to get busy. That's all it means.
That's what I was going to say. I'm glad it's March 24th and we only got another 7 days till April 1st, but, mm-hmm. You know, April, not my favorite time to hunt bear. I don't know about you. If you're going up in the high alpine, I imagine you probably wait till what, May, till you start getting up there and the snow line starts receding a little bit.
I'm fortunate again where I live here. I'm right in the mountains. So starting in April, I'll start going on drives and I'll go on hikes and I'll see how high up I can get. And I try and be like, you know, the first one to be up into some of these areas. So it fully depends on what the weather's going to do. But yes, typically higher country isn't going to kind of perk up until a little later in the spring.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say 2 years ago, I mean, I took my spring bear literally the last day of the spring season, but it had a mouthful of berries when I walked up to it. So it was worth the wait.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all depending on the weather. You know, right now in the Okanagan here, we've got an early spring. So mm-hmm. I think you're going to find, and I found success in BC, we really don't have much of a choice. It's spot and stalk or still hunting them. And for me, myself, I prefer the still hunt. I like that. It's archery, still hunting bears. It's a lot of fun. It's hard work though. And without the use of trail cameras, I don't think I could do it. But I found the most success was just those south facing slopes where there's lots of green grass. And again, yeah, it all depends on what the weather's doing. If it's an early spring, it's gonna change what time of the year you can go, for sure.
Oh, definitely. And I mean, that's one thing for that style of hunting. I found it's always best, like you said, to get into the areas before the full effect of spring is going, you know, before everything's greened up. You want to get to areas where, you know, the edges of the roads are greened up, the south sides of the hills are greened up nice, but in the trees and the other areas, it hasn't greened up as much. So you can kind of at least focus your attention on a few key zones and areas, and you'll have a better idea of where the bears are going to be at that time. Right. So I think that definitely has a big impact on success rates.
That's what I found too, is, you know, the south facing slopes where water can get and it can lay there for a bit. And I find too, is that they're really after stuff, the berries, first thing, right? They're trying to get that plug out. They're trying to get as much as they can with the least amount of effort. At least that's what I find. I don't know about your experience, but they seem to congregate more, easier to locate a little earlier. And plus there's not a lot of guys out either. You know, there's not a lot of traffic and it's not hot out yet. So you have a little bit more luck with during the day as opposed to just early morning and late night.
Yeah. No, definitely. And I mean, a lot of my buddies and I too, we like to go kind of bear hunt in some areas around where we do a lot of our deer hunting as well. And you always feel good when you get to take a nice bear first and foremost, obviously. So you're excited about the bear, but then if you're in an area where, you know, like earlier that day or later that evening, you spot a bunch of does walking around and you're like, okay, great. Well, I've probably helped out a few fawns this spring as well. So, I mean, all of that, it's kind of nice to help out that ecosystem, that specific area where you're focused.
Yeah.
So those are kind of the tactics that we typically use over here when we're picking where we want to go chase. But mm-hmm. I always tell my friends I'm out blacktail shed hunting, but
yeah,
that's like finding a needle in a haystack. I haven't found too many blacktail sheds in my day.
Yeah, that's one thing. When I said I take the kids out, that, you know, the kids are looking for sheds and I'm looking for turned over rocks where a bear's been digging and eating some bugs and that kind of stuff. So I just love spring bear hunting. It's funny, you know, same kind of thing as you. You know, my dad, he was just a moose hunter. That was it. We grew up on the north, and Houston was the big spot to hit. So every year it was a moose hunt. So they never got into black bear hunting, and it's just something I kind of got into myself down here. But it's a lot of fun. You ever try calling bears in?
No. I've seen a lot of videos of it, and I actually have a predator call in my backpack normally when I'm out hunting in the spring, but to this day I've never sat down and actually actively tried to call one in before.
I've had the most luck, but this is a little later on too. I found it when the bears are a little more aggressive, when it gets closer to the rut. Mm-hmm. I found they work a little better, like the distress fawn or the fawn bleat call also works good. But again, I've never had a lot of luck with calls during you know, the earlier months when they're mm-hmm. they're mostly just, you know, they're all after the green stuff, whatever they can get easy to.
I've never really done the predator calling. Maybe I'll have to try that out.
But yeah,
well, I also really like using spring bear as a good time to start, you know, getting back into the quote unquote sneaky mode and use it for good training for, you know, the fall hunts and all of that as well. So I try and get out there and have as little of impact as possible while I'm actively hunting, but it's always exciting at the same time to try a new method. So I might have to put that to use and actually pull that call out of my backpack this spring when I'm out there.
Yeah. I think the one thing about calling is that typically when you call animals, the biggest mistake you can make is overcalling. With bears, it's the opposite. Like it's impossible to overcall. I mean, you have to call for an hour and a half. And what I found is that as soon as you stop calling, that bear will stop coming towards the call. Like he'll just stop. I've watched bears when you stop calling, they'll just stop moving. And then they kind of get distracted and they just, you know, they're kind of like people, right? They're like kids. They just, you know, they get sidetracked easy. But I found for myself, the most success is you gotta wail on that thing for a while to get their attention.
You gotta commit to it. Get out there and say, okay, today's whole process is calling.
Yeah. But back to what you said about just being sneaky. Yeah. That's, you know, getting out into the woods and sneaking around. Yeah. That's a fun time as well. Just getting back into that mode. And that's why I love doing the still hunt. I like walking, you know, the logging roads quietly. And again, you find them just on the side of the roads, and typically later afternoon and early evening is when I found them to be most predominant in like the mid May. And just walking along the old roads, the Forestry Service roads, and just, but you got to be quiet because if they catch your wind or if they hear you, they're gone. So
it doesn't take much, and it is amazing how quickly those bears can disappear into like in the middle of a field, and they take 10 steps and it's where the heck did they go? Like this giant black blob somehow just disappears.
Yeah. But, and I think people think that bears are slow. Like when they run in the bush, I am blown away with how fast those things can run in the bush. It's amazing.
Yeah. I would never win it out running a bear. I'll tell you that much. not only how fast they could run, but I mean, if you've seen many bears that tree for whatever reason, they can climb a tree damn near as fast as they can run. Like they will get to the top of the tree without breaking stride, run flat ground, hit that tree, and they're at the top of it in the blink of an eye. And it's amazing to think about how heavy these animals are. And it's funny because when you watch them, they look so complacent and dopey, and they look like you could just walk up to them and cuddle with them like a teddy bear. But when you see them and they get into this territorial mode or you know, that kill mode, and that switch turns, like they are unbelievable.
Yeah, they're amazing
predators. Like they're machines, and the reason they walk around the bush and they look so dopey and casual and complacent is because they know they are dominant, and they are. That's not a dopiness. It's just this swagger and confidence, I think, that they have when they're out there, and they're just like, yeah, I don't have to be scared right now because I can handle my shit.
Yeah.
But when that switch flicks, like you do not want to be on the wrong end of that.
Absolutely not. Man, I missed a dream colored phase bear last year. Ooh. Still kicking myself for it. But hopefully this year I get after him. I'm going to be going to that same area. Hopefully he's a local and he doesn't stray too far. But that's one funny thing about bears is pretty unpredictable critters.
Absolutely. You'll have some that are territorial and maybe it's there at the time in their life where they've won enough battles in that area. But then, yeah, exactly. Especially once you get into their rut, you'll have those boars that are just cruising and you never know where they're going to end up. You see them in one cut, you know, one or two times, and you think you're going to be able to come back to that same cut later in the year and see them. And they're, who knows where they're at after that day, they just disappear.
Yeah. A lot of fun, Joe. And I think I'm going to wrap this up. So maybe you can let everybody know where we can find The Edge and where we can follow you on Instagram and Facebook.
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me on here. As we mentioned earlier, I'm a co-host on our show, The Edge. It's on Wild TV. I started in season 10. Season 11 actually kicks off here pretty quick. And then season 12 is what we're going to be filming starting in the next few weeks. So you can find me on there. And then on Instagram, let me check. I'm terrible. So my Instagram is just my first and last name. So it's Joe_Appel. So you can pull that up on Instagram and Facebook. Just look me up by name as well. So I'm always up for a good conversation.
You bet. Thanks for taking a bit of time and chatting with me and, you know, telling all my listeners, I'm sure they all know who you are anyway by now, but, you know, it's always good to touch base.
Kevin, I appreciate you having me on, and I hope this is the first of many conversations and chats we have here.
Okay. Sounds good, man. Talk later.
Ciao.
Do you believe that? Wow. I guess it's all worth it.